It's almost impossible to discuss cinema without acknowledging the effect film music has on our experience. But while it's hard to imagine our favorite films without music, it's also hard for most people to remember what they've heard or name more than one or two great film composers. I'm Charles Horek, and you're listening to On Film. My guest today has, for a number of years, taught and written on the subject of film scoring and film composers. Dr. Charles Leinberger is an associate professor in the Department of Music at the University of Texas at El Paso and is the author of a book on Ennio Morricone's iconic score for The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly. And I'm delighted to have him on the program for the first time, at least the first time for me.
The first time for you.
I know you were here, what, 9 years ago with Cynthia Haynes?
It was about 9 years ago when my book came out.
Fantastic. I think I met you then at a book signing at Barnes & Noble for that book.
I think so. Did I sign your book?
Yes, and I have enjoyed reading it. So you are teaching here in the Department of Music, mostly for music majors discussing theory, but occasionally you write and teach on film music.
Yeah, we offer some classes for non-music majors in the music literature area, like music appreciation, jazz, mm-hmm. Turok, things like that. And I have a film music topic that I teach once or twice a year. And it turns out to be extremely popular. The class always fills up because movies are so much a part of everybody's life and mm-hmm. our pop culture. And music, as you mentioned, is so much a part of the movie viewing / listening experience. Mm-hmm. And so many people do kind of take it for granted that the music was just automatically there through some magic microphone, like when you make a video on your phone. And right. a lot of skill and a lot of craft and a lot of history goes into what we hear when we go to the movies.
You know, we talk about watching movies. We don't talk about listening to movies.
So exactly.
And our eyes take up so much room out of our brain, right?
In a little talk I do each year before the UTEP Symphony Orchestra does a concert of film music every spring. And I do a pre-concert talk called Music, What Music? Because so many times mm-hmm. after movie, I'll say, you know, I really enjoyed the music. And someone always says, music? What music? You
right. know,
and it's there, and it affects your experience, and sometimes you're unaware of it. And I think it was Max Steiner who said, if you are aware of it, then the composer didn't do a good job.
Well, I think that's the trick there is, you know, there are three things, I think, that are the invisible arts of film, and that's editing, cinematography, and the music. And oftentimes, when they become obvious, it takes you out of the film. And so there is that quandary with composers of how invisible to remain, mm-hmm. yet without the music, we would not be engaged in what we're watching.
Sometimes composers and directors don't agree on when there should be music in
right.
a film and when
right.
there shouldn't be. When I was researching Max Steiner's Now Voyager score, mm-hmm. there's a cue in the score that when you watch the scene, it's not there. He wrote it, and then it didn't end up in the final edit.
Mm-hmm. That's the Bette Davis Warner Brothers film,
yes.
and one of the great film scores of all time that a lot of people study. Let's talk briefly about when you're dealing with people. You know, I'm not a musician. I'm not a composer. Most of the people I know who go to movies are not that conscious of the impact the film music is having on what they're watching and how they're being engaged by it. How does one begin to develop a discipline of understanding what's happening in real time while you're watching a film?
Well, we usually start out by talking about where the music's coming from.
Hmm.
Is it coming from something that exists in the story created by the movie? We call that source music.
Like a radio in the background. Or
exactly. Maybe a musician in a bar, a radio in the background, you know, a band at a outdoor concert. Or is it, if it's music that only the audience hears, then we call that underscoring.
Mm-hmm.
So knowing where the music comes from is the first step. A good exercise is to watch a film without any sound.
Hmm.
A famous example is in Psycho, the scene where she's driving from Phoenix to California mm-hmm. in the rainstorm and the windshield wipers are going back and forth. And Bernard Herrmann's music is so suspenseful. And yet without it, the scene
she's
really
just driving.
Isn't very interesting. But the best answer is take my class.
There you go, which I may do next semester. It sounds intriguing because that's certainly something that even as with as many films as I watch, it's something that I struggle with, being able to follow the story, the cinematography, the editing, the music all simultaneously. Maybe that's why film is so rich because mm-hmm. we can see layers every time we watch a film. You know, over time, I guess the approach of composers to how to score films has changed. And you mentioned Now Voyager. That's a classic example of a Hollywood classic era, golden age film score. Are there certain types of music and approaches to film scoring that we should be aware of?
Well, let me put it this way, from my point of view. When I started researching film music about 20 years ago, I had this romantic image of people like Max Steiner and Dmitri Tiomkin and Alfred Newman sitting at a grand piano and putting their pencil to the paper and magical things happening. And now I kind of burst my bubble when I learned that when a studio hires a composer, they're really hiring the director of the music department. And their job really isn't to compose the score, but just deliver a score on time and under budget. And whether they write a note or not doesn't matter. And there are some people in Hollywood who are very good at this, licensing pre-existing music, using music in the public domain. And the rest of the composing actually takes very little time.
Right. But so even in the classic period where there were music directors at each studio and it was a factory setting, oftentimes in those classic golden age films, you have individual themes written for characters. So when you hear that music, it reminds you, okay, this is the music for that character. And we don't often hear that kind of film scoring in today's films.
It fell out of fashion for a while. There's a name for that. It's the leitmotif score because it's built on the tradition that Richard Wagner used in his operas. And Max Steiner, being the good Austrian that he was, brought that technique with him and used it in his early film scores in the 30s and 40s and 50s. And it fell out of fashion in the 1960s when, after A Hard Day's Night and Help, people realized that there was money to be made if your film score was also a popular record.
That's right, if you were licensing those titles.
Exactly. And a lot of movie studios also owned record companies, Warner Brothers, Columbia, United Artists. So that really fell out of fashion for a while until John Williams brought it back with Jaws and Close Encounters and Star Wars.
And I know early Spielberg and Lucas really fought to have scores and not a bunch of popular music. I'm thinking also of one of my favorite scores of that period, The Big Wednesday, Basil Poledouris, who's fully scored as a surfer movie, which you would think would be filled with surfing music that they could license and sell singles and LPs back then. But he wrote a full score, and that's what the director wanted. And that was the beginning of that change, I think. Of course, Martin Scorsese still uses commercial music, particularly the Rolling Stones, which he loves. But he selects those titles and those cues specifically to say something about what that scene is about. Let me ask you, though, with your students, you know, we live in such a saturated world of media now. Are they more savvy about what's going on in the music side of the imagery they're seeing, or are they just as clueless as I am?
No, I think they are more savvy. We've gotten into some really interesting discussions in my class because I'll say something that I assume is to be correct, and someone else will say, well, you know, I've seen that and I interpret it differently. It could be where the music's coming from. It could be what the music means or why it's there.
You mentioned that around the 60s and early 70s, things were beginning to change back. And one of the great examples is, of course, an example that you wrote a book about, Ennio Morricone, is The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, which came out in this country in 1967, a little earlier in Italy. But that score is iconic, and I think most people, even if they haven't seen the film, know the music. Was it revolutionary for its time?
It was, because at the time, Hollywood film composers, even when writing for Westerns, would use the symphony orchestra and write very much like their favorite classical composers in major and minor keys, orchestral music. Once in a while, you'd hear a guitar or harmonica, something that would make sense along with the storyline. But then along comes Morricone and puts an electric guitar in a Western, which is a complete anachronism. It doesn't make sense. Why is it there? And he uses all sorts of exotic instruments, one called an ocarina, strange percussion sounds that really have no place in that time period or in that location. And yet,
whistling.
Whistling. You might expect. But now it's influenced so many other composers since then that it's hard to imagine a Western without those sounds.
There's a great score for a recent Western, 310 to Yuma, the remake, that Marco Beltrami wrote this score for, and it's very reminiscent of Morricone's work. I can see him blending some of that Italian spaghetti Western music back into that. When you were writing that book, you got to meet Morricone, certainly a giant in the film composing world.
Yes, my wife and I went to Rome, and we met him at his home, and he played piano for us. And I had a wonderful interview. I had an interpreter, even though I had been studying Italian. He didn't want me speaking Italian, only my interpreter, whose name was Sister Sarah, which he thought was funny.
It's because he wrote the film score for Two Mules for Sister Sarah.
That's right. But it was a wonderful interview. I really enjoyed our visit. There were some questions about some of his composing techniques that he was hesitant to explain in detail.
Not tell you the magic trick of how it happens.
Mm-hmm.
Keep it a secret.
Which I kind of took as a challenge. There's a technique I had read about called the microcell technique, and I asked him about that. And he said, well, if I tell you, you'll write about it, and other people will imitate that, and I don't want that to happen. And it turns out, because of the book, I was contacted by a private collector who had, among other things, an original manuscript of one of the cues from The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly. And I was able to figure out what this microcell technique was. So I took the challenge. I haven't written about it, although I did submit an article on it, and thank goodness it wasn't accepted. I could still, if we ever have another conversation, I can tell him, Maestro, I have not written about it. I've talked about it.
You've kept the secret. So someone like that in the 60s coming up, that was fairly early in his career. Is that a revolutionary idea, or was it evolutionary in that he was drawing from other sources that spurred him on, or did he just wake up one day and had that tune
well,
in his head?
At that point in time, he had a background as a music producer in Rome of popular songs. So it's really a textbook example of thesis, antithesis, and over time, the two become a synthesis of those two opposites. So he really brought to the table something completely fresh and different for the Western soundtrack genre. And it's been assimilated by so many other composers that we really can't imagine the genre without it.
And, of course, audiences at the time really sat up and took notice of that because it was
so
different.
The critics hated it.
The critics hated it, but the audiences said, that's different.
Had a cult following immediately.
I know that you're teaching a course next semester in film music, and I guess you're also constantly researching for papers and academic journals and things?
Yeah, I have a few articles I have in mind for to follow up on my research I've done on Morricone. His use of the trumpet, I'm a trumpet player, so I'm always fascinated by the clever way he uses the trumpet in his Western film scores. There's a lot of evidence to suggest it was influenced by Dmitri Tiomkin and his score for Rio Bravo.
Yes.
And I'm doing some research on that, along with some really expert help from Rick Baptist, who is a Hollywood trumpet player and friend of mine. If you ever watch Dancing with the Stars, you see him on there once in a while in the band. I also visited the Warner Brothers Studios in 2011 and was granted access to Morricone's score for some of his American films, including one that I'm really interested in called Disclosure, Michael Douglas and Demi Moore, early 1990s.
Yeah.
He did a score that's quite different than a lot of what he did that he's best known for, his Western scores. And that's another upcoming project of mine.
Sounds like you will be back on the show soon. Keep it up. Thank you for opening this door for us, because this is a topic that I need to learn way more about. So appreciate you coming into the studio today.
My pleasure.
I've been discussing film music and the art of composing for the screen with Dr. Charles Lineberger, associate professor in the Department of Music at the University of Texas at El Paso. His 2004 book on Ennio Morricone's iconic film score for The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly was published by the Scarecrow Press and is available from the usual online booksellers. On Films Producers, Norma Martinez, an archive of past programs is available on this station's website at ktep.org. I'm Charles Horak. Thank you for listening to On Film.